More than 800,000 people in the southeast are still without power following Hurricane Katrina. Entire towns along the Gulf Coast are little more than splinters. Those who remain in New Orleans are under a mandatory evacuation order as officers continue to go house to house. And even though the pumps are starting to do their work, much of the city's infrastructure will spend the next several weeks sitting in contaminated water. On his first visit to the area, President Bush pledged to rebuild what the storm took away. But there are no easy answers for communities devastated by Katrina. Along the Mississippi coast, residents wait for federal reconstruction money and for decisions about the return of the casino industry. In New Orleans, the questions are even more fundamental. What can be salvaged from the floodwater? How much can both the government and the private sector, how much will they rebuild? How can a city that is slowly sinking further below sea level protect itself from future disasters? And they're asking about the size and the character of the New Orleans. This is not the first American city to have its future threatened by natural disaster. San Francisco rebuilt after its earthquake, Chicago after its fire. But Galveston never quite came back from its storm. And there are still people living in tents in Florida trying to reconstruct what last year's hurricanes took away. Today we look at what stories of other disaster-stricken communities can teach us about the future for Katrina's victims. Later on in the program, Governor Schwarzenegger's dilemma. He's got a gay marriage bill on his desk and trouble, whether he signs it or not. But first, rebuilding is the talk of the nation. If you lost your home or your entire community to a natural disaster, flood, fire, hurricane, earthquake, did you rebuild? Why or why not? And if you did rebuild, how did it change the character of your town? Join the conversation. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. The slow, difficult work of rebuilding goes on long after the media has turned its eyes to other stories. We first talked with Florida Postman Chuck Cantizano last year when he was delivering the mail right after his town and his house were devastated by Hurricane Charley. He joins us again today by cell phone. He happens to be in Disney World today. Charley, thanks for taking the time out from vacation to talk with us.
It's a pleasure, Neil.
What kind of shape is your town, Punta Gorda? What kind of shape is it in today?
Little by little, it's being rebuilt. You have a lot of people have spent a lot of money and a lot of time. What seems to be going in has been done in a much better and safer way. But then you go down the block and you'll find vacant lots still, or homes that have been literally untouched from the day after the hurricane.
What's the hardest part of rebuilding?
Stamina. It's a very exhausting process. You're battling with insurance. You're battling with your own feelings of whether to do it. You're looking at the amount of money you're going to spend out of pocket above and beyond the insurance to upgrade and make it more hurricane-proof. If we're going to stay here, you have to do it right.
Well, did you ever think about packing it up?
Oh, yeah. We had all our stuff. I was very grateful. A friend of mine was able to get me a tractor-trailer, so we were able to save a lot of my contents. And we put it on the tractor-trailer. I don't mind. I think there was more than one time when we thought, you know what, maybe we ought to hook that tractor-trailer up and ride on down the road.
Now, you're talking about people making decisions about their houses, and, of course, that's tough enough. But what about the city's infrastructure, schools, city government, or, for that matter, the post office?
Well, that's one of the things, you know, for the first seven months, the kids were going to school in the next town north, which my boys are very active. I have five sons. They're very active in after-school activity, so it was constantly the run half an hour north to go get them, to drop them off. You know, they weren't able to take the bus if they were involved in the after-school programs. And that also was tiring, you know. But they right now they're back in their own schools. I believe just about everybody is. Unfortunately, it's not their school. It's portable schools. They actually have them set up just like the FEMA village. They've set up a portable, all portables with walkways, metal walkways covered. That's their school now. They go to all their classes are in portables. The school itself, it'll probably be, I would imagine, 2 to 3 years before they're rebuilt.
How would you say the town has changed since Hurricane Charley?
I think it'll be a better town when all is said and done. Property values, to everybody's amazement, increased despite the storm and the devastation. Real estate is at a premium. Lots have gone up incredibly. But it takes a lot of money to do this, and it takes a lot of time and a lot of stamina. And getting a hold of contractors is a problem. Getting things rebuilt is a problem. I mean, I need a new septic system. There was damage done to the septic drain field and everything with all the water. you call for estimates and they're telling you point blank, we won't even be able to, we're not giving estimates and we couldn't even think about getting to you for 12 to 18 months.
You're not still in that trailer, though. Is your house done?
We got out of the trailer. Thank God we got our bedrooms done and a bathroom in the house completed right at the, around the beginning of April. And we moved out of the, we were in a motorhome and a FEMA, and FEMA was good. And FEMA came and saw us all in the motorhome. There were seven of us living in a 31-foot Winnebago. And they told us we were still eligible for a trailer despite the fact that we had gone out and purchased the motorhome. And they brought us a trailer. So we put the boys in the trailer and we L-shaped it. It looked like a little city on my front porch, on my front lawn.
If you had a piece of advice to the people along the Mississippi Gulf Coast or in New Orleans today, what would it be?
Just videotape everything, photograph everything, document it. And if you're going to if your house is only damaged and not gone completely, don't wait. Get in there as soon as they allow you to get that wet stuff out of there, because people who waited on their insurance settlements to begin the process then had a much bigger bigger project because the mold had begun to grow to the beams and now you needed mold treatments, etc. We were literally in there before we had electricity back on. I photographed, we were running off generators. We photographed everything, I mean 1,000 digital photos. We videotaped every square inch of the damage and we started gutting. The electricity wasn't on. My son's, two of my boys' houses were also destroyed in Port Charlotte. So they were out at our house because at least we had one room which we could put an air conditioner in. We literally put all the beds, just bedroomed the whole floor. And that's how we stayed for the first couple of weeks, all in one room with one window unit air conditioner. And we were better off than many because I'm on a well, so I could hook my well up and have running water. I could then hook up the air conditioner, have air conditioner. We keep refrigerated. So we were better than many for that, I believe it was about 18 or 20 days without electricity. And we were lucky enough to be able to get a generator, you know.
Well, Chuck Cantizano, thanks very much again for talking with us. Say hi to Mickey for me, will you?
All righty. You have a good one.
All right. Chuck Cantizano is a resident of Punta Gorda, Florida, and joined us by cell phone from he's on vacation down in Disney World. We go down to now to the other end of the hurricane coast. Walter Peacock directs the Hazard Reduction and Recovery Center at Texas A&M University. He's the author of Hurricane Andrew, Ethnicity, Gender, and the Sociology of Disaster. He's with us by phone from his office in College Station, Texas, and it's good of you to be with us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
When you have a disaster the magnitude of New Orleans, the Gulf Coast communities where nothing was left standing, where do you even start with reconstruction?
Well, as I think Chuck gave a little bit of a picture, it is a complex process made up of thousands of households, thousands of businesses, and many different government entities all making decisions, all trying to make decisions at the same time. And out of that, we hope, emerges a reconstituted community. So it is a very, very complex process.
And at this point, one of the persistent problems in and out of New Orleans, in many other areas, is who's in charge?
Oh, absolutely. And at this stage, especially in the response, emergency response, everybody looks for an entity or a person to be in charge. And fundamentally, we need that. I mean, the types of issues we're dealing with right now, we need a kind of centralized or at least a coordinated activity, a coordinated a response, because we have to have government, especially the federal government, come in and help rescue people. We're dealing with life-threatening situations at this point. Mm-hmm. We need a person in charge. When it comes to the long-term process, though, and the long-term rebuilding, we here in the United States do things very differently than they do, for example, in Europe. We depend upon the market to do it. And the market means, just as Chuck was alluding to, finding the contractors, getting money from the insurance company, getting money perhaps from the SBA, for whatever sources possible to rebuild our homes, rebuild our apartment complexes, rebuild ultimately our communities.
And those we all take individual decisions about our homes and that sort of thing, but the elected officials have to take the decisions about the community.
Well, absolutely. I mean, the elected officials, both at the local level, but really, you know, at this point, when we're looking at a community like Hurricane Andrew, Miami after Hurricane Andrew, New Orleans, Northridge, and dealing with those situations after the earthquake there, it really depends upon a lot of governmental action to bring back infrastructure. People, you won't see the reinvestments in New Orleans unless we get the levees rebuilt, unless we get the levees probably strengthened. We get the infrastructure up, the bridges back up, the roads back up, and then, of course, the utility and utility companies have to be involved as well. So it takes coordinated effort. It takes effort by public officials and, more broadly, by our government. After that, though, and when it comes to rebuilding your homes and issues along those lines, then we're really into the multitude of decisions that have to be made by oftentimes homeowners. But we need to remember that, for example, in the New Orleans case, you know, over 53% of the population were renters. They don't have the same kind of decisions and responsibility, but they do have, of course, the responsibility of trying to find homes for their families and the like, but they cannot take those actions. Now we're talking about businesses and developers taking actions and making decisions.
Let's see if we get a caller on the line, and this is Ed. Ed's calling us from Portland, Oregon.
Hi. I was just the talk about New Orleans and how it's being, you know, below sea level, which is attributed to the major problem. Remind me of a in the 50s, my hometown of Portland had a suburb called Fort that was built below the level of the surrounding rivers, and after a major storm, it got flooded, and thousands of people made homeless and everything. And I know at least here in Portland, they just decided to abandon the city rather than rebuild in its location. And I know New Orleans has a lot of history, but I mean, it does make me wonder why there is even any serious consideration of rebuilding when it's, I mean, it's one levee breaking, and there it goes again.
Well, at least parts of the city. It's an interesting point, Ed. We'll get to that after the break. Thanks very much for calling with us.
Thank you.
We're calling, if you'd like to join the conversation, it's 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. We'll be back after the break. I'm Neil Conan, and it's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. After a disaster like Katrina, the public pressure to rebuild can be enormous. What does it really take for a city to rebuild from the ground up? Is there the political will to ask hard questions about what's worth rebuilding and what isn't? Rebuilding after disaster is the talk of the nation today. From San Francisco with its earthquake to Galveston with its hurricane, cities across the country have faced this question through the years and with many different answers. If you've tried to rebuild after natural disaster, tell us about your experience. If you decided not to, why not? 800-989-8255. Email is totn@npr.org. Still with us from College Station, Texas, is Walter Peacock, director of the Hazard Reduction and Recovery Center at Texas A&M. And let's get another caller on the line. And this is Heather. And Heather's calling us from Nuremberg in Germany.
Yeah, hi. How you doing?
Very well, thank you.
I've just been so distraught about what's in New Orleans. I went to school there back in the 80s. And lived there for 6 years. And part of what made the city so great was the closeness of the different socioeconomic groups. And your guest was mentioning that there were so many renters. And I'm concerned about the rebuilding process, sort of meaning that people who own the lots will sell them to other people who have more money, and that some of what made New Orleans so great will be lost in the course of that. So I'm choosing Habitat for Humanity as my charity of choice.
Well,
because I think I have a lot of hope for the work that they might do there.
Walter Peacock, you studied what happened after Hurricane Andrew. Does demographics, how did that change after a storm?
Well, there's a real possibility to have major changes that could occur, and especially in this case. I think Heather brings up an excellent point. I mean, the fact is that we have a very large component of the population in New Orleans that is rental housing, renters themselves. We have, 27, 20, almost 28% of the population that were living below poverty. markets, for all their wonder, and they do marvelous jobs in terms of rebuilding. So much of the housing that was rebuilt after Hurricane Andrew was made possible because of that. But markets have also failed. They fail systematically to bring housing for low-income households. Affordable housing becomes a real issue, and that's why we have to have programs like HUD and other types of programs, community block grants, to try to facilitate that. And we really got to see that type of action take place in this context. Otherwise, there is a very, very real threat that we won't see that richness, we won't see the diversity that was once New Orleans come back. In addition, there are the simple problems with we have got essentially the entire population gone. And large components of that population simply will not be able to come back. And again, those at most risk, the low-income households, minority households that are being distributed throughout the entire nation indeed now, are struggling. They're going to have to get jobs, get kids back in school, and it is very difficult to come back in those situations. So we're dealing with a very unique situation here. There has to be then, in this situation, government action to ensure that we get the broad spectrum of housing back, that we get a broad-based community redeveloping in those areas.
Heather, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Let's talk now with the mayor of Grand Forks, South North Dakota. Grand Forks flooded for 2 weeks in 1997 after the Red River overflowed its banks. And joining us now to talk about that city's recovery is City Manager Rick Duquette. Good of you to be with us today.
Thank you very much.
Tell us a bit about the flood. Did those pictures from New Orleans look familiar?
They do, but they're hundreds, if not thousands, of times worse than what we had in our community. It was in 1997. We the Red River flows between North Dakota and Minnesota, and we had record snowfalls that year, and a huge flood in our communities of Grand Forks and East Grand Forks from the overflowing Red River.
So a huge difference in scale, I'm sure. But how much of your city had to be rebuilt?
Well, we lost about 8,000 homes were affected by the actual flood, and we knocked down about 1,000 homes near the river. 75% of our community was covered with water, and East Grand Forks, Minnesota, had about 95%. So we had some extensive home rebuilding, and just about all of our downtown had to be rebuilt.
And was there ever a feeling that maybe the town shouldn't be rebuilt or should be moved to safer ground?
There are those. That thinking does happen. There's certainly a series of thoughts right after the disaster of, you know, gosh, maybe we shouldn't do anything. But by working through that and with some strong presence of help from the nation and sitting down and thinking about the identity of your community, you can begin to focus on rebuilding that community.
How did your town change after the reconstruction?
We've actually come back very strong. We're a growing community. We're a small town of about 55,000 people, and we're a border city between North Dakota and Minnesota, and East Grand Forks has about 9,000 people. Businesses are flourishing. We have people coming in. We're the home of the University of North Dakota. It's been a long haul from 97, but we are doing well.
Is there any advice that you might give to people, in your situation along the Gulf Coast and in Louisiana?
Well, again, keeping in mind that
differences of scale, yes.
Huge difference of scale. It's going to be very difficult for a long time, very difficult. You need to work as a community, have a strong federal and state and national presence with this situation, and realize that working as a community and keeping your identity, you can rebuild, but it's going to be a long haul. There will be some people that will never be the same. There's no doubt about it, but keeping that perspective, you can come back.
Rick Duquette, thanks very much, and continued good luck to you.
Take care. Thank you.
Rick Duquette, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Sorry.
Walter, go ahead.
I could just jump in a second. I think some of the issues that he raised there are particularly important. You know, getting the business community back is so important. And a large component of that business community, especially in New Orleans, are small businesses. You know, the small restaurants that brought so much flavor in so many ways to that city are examples. Small businesses are the most susceptible and vulnerable to not coming back because they don't have business interruption insurance. They don't have those possibilities. So we really need to see concerted effort there again, that there could be some policies to help insure and promote and those businesses to get back to business. The other thing is, thinking again about homeowners, there are so many people now that are going to be experiencing questions from their mortgage company about their mortgage payments and the like, and especially the lower income households that have been able to scratch out the American dream and own that home. We really need to look at issues like that and see whether or not there should be perhaps some moratorium on mortgage payments for 60 or 90 days until people can get back on their feet.
Rick Duquette, if you're still with us.
I am.
Would you agree with those points?
I would. You know, it's critical. We put together a business redevelopment task force. We worked with the SBA. We worked with local mortgage companies to do many of the things that gentleman describes. Those are important steps, and you need to bring smart people together to help you think about those things and move those projects forward.
Thanks again very much for being with us today.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Rick Duquette is City Administrator of Grand Forks in North Dakota. Let's get another caller on the line, and this is Alana. Alana calling us from Tucson, Arizona.
Hi there, Neil. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
3 years ago, in the summer of 2002, we had a very large forest fire that took out the town of Mount Lemmon, Arizona. The town was completely leveled with the exception of a few buildings. Businesses got first priority in the rebuilding, but a lot of people had found that they were either uninsured or underinsured to rebuild. And with building costs skyrocketing, only a small percentage of people have really chosen to come back. And so we are still in this very, very long process, and even my parents, as they're rebuilding, have found that things are just taking much, much longer than they had planned. And the only advice I'd be able to offer to anyone in the same situation is to please be patient. Realize that there are tons of community resources out there that would like to support you and really are there for you, but that it's going to take a while.
Is the town ever going to be the same?
They're trying. They're trying so hard. As I said, businesses received first priority in the rebuilding, and there was a huge celebration as the first businesses did reopen. One of the businesses was untouched by fire, and they made it very clear they were open to serve sandwiches and cold drinks to the firefighters as they continued to battle the blaze through the end of the summer. It was a very extensive fire. And it's coming back slowly. It's hard to say for right now, but the biggest problem we're finding is that a lot of people were drawn to this community because it was in the heart of southern Arizona, 8,000 feet on top of a mountain. It was nice up there. And now there really aren't the pine trees. There's not the same environment. And a lot of people are being deterred because they feel they're not going to see that again. And indeed, they are not going to see those pine trees for another 50, 60 years. Hmm. We're just going to see other vegetation in the process.
Alana, thanks very much, and good luck.
Thank you, Neil.
And let me ask you about that, Walter Peacock. A lot of the reasons that people lived in New Orleans was the romantic attachment of the place. Of course, their roots go back, but a lot of the reasons people visited New Orleans and it thrived on the tourist industry, and that's going to be difficult to recapture.
Boy, it certainly is, and that is something that we know, and we've certainly heard a lot about over the last number of days about the attachment to place that we see for many that live in New Orleans. The hope, again, would be that we can get as many people back on their feet and have the opportunity to move back to begin to recapture that. It could be a real danger as well, too, as Alana was mentioning about, you know, other people buying up homes and or you know, not being able to rebuild, because there could be that attempt to make it almost like a Disney World place where it's recaptured artificially. And I think one of the things that we need to be concerned about is recapturing it actually through the people that were there. The other issue, I think.
Let me ask you about that. You're somewhat concerned that New Orleans could turn into a sort of a French Quarter and Preservation Hall theme park.
It could be so dangerous that we lose the richness, the earthiness, the diversity, again, if we don't get that comprehensive rebuilding plan back to help promote bringing back and recreating that richness. If we lose large minority community in New Orleans, if it becomes more upscale, more gentrified, then there's a real danger that it will not be the New Orleans it was. It will not be the New Orleans that we have come to appreciate in this country that's given us so much richness in our arts and our culture.
Mm-hmm. But that will depend on a lot of businesses returning to New Orleans. And businesses like shipping, oil, those people are going to stay in business. They're going to relocate, at least for the time being, and they may relocate permanently.
They may well relocate permanently. That's why issues related to building back better, building the levee systems back. I mean, why would they invest those major capital, that major capital investment if it is at risk yet again? So there are, where government will be critical in terms of many of the structural elements in terms of mitigation, again, the levee system and the like.
If you look at the lessons, though, of places like San Francisco and Chicago, did people build in a they say, well, look, we've got to make it bigger and better than ever. We've got to have all this wonderful infrastructure before people will come back. Did they do it in a planned, careful way, or was it higgly-piggly?
Higgly-piggly. It ends up all too often being that way. It really ends up being for the long course. But there's something fundamentally different in this situation. But let me first address that long course issue. We saw it after Hurricane Andrew. People needed to rebuild. They needed to get back into their homes. They were oftentimes living in those homes. They were built those homes back, not necessarily using more stringent building codes. And yet, newer building codes did come into pass, and they are now indeed some of the strongest building codes in the country, most effective for dealing with wind issues. There is that risk that if you delay too long, people will never be able to come back, and so it's a very, very difficult situation. But we cannot lose this opportunity to consider how it is we ought to be rebuilding back and to build back better. Now, in this situation, for better or worse, there is this window. Now, we know that it's going to take time for the water to get pumped out. We know it's going to take time for things to be analyzed in terms of the toxicity of the deposits laid in there, or decisions about homes and mold and things like that. So there is going to be a delay here that we can use effectively to ensure that we are building back better and building back stronger communities.
We're talking about reconstruction after disaster. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller on the line. This is Brian. Brian is calling us from Michigan.
Hi, how you doing?
All right.
Well, I was very interested in hearing about the North Dakota disaster because I got wiped out in that flood. I don't think what people realize is you can only hold your breath so long. By the time my house was completely and utterly destroyed, I lost everything. And don't get me wrong, I was very grateful for all the help we got. But the bureaucracy that you have to go through is unbelievable. Between FEMA, the insurance companies, even getting the state to reissue licenses for my job. I'm a nurse. I needed to reprove that I have a state license. By the time all of that happened, by the time the mortgage company finally got around to giving me a moratorium, I was completely and totally financially wiped out. So I chose to move away. We live in Michigan because it is rated as one of the states having the lowest rate of natural disasters. And I think the people who are going to rebuild New Orleans, it's moronic. It's below sea level. It's all going to happen again. And it's a terrible loss. It was a city, it was a great city, but unfortunately was at the wrong place, and evidently now we've seen it the wrong time.
Brian, just to follow up, you moved to Michigan because you looked at a survey and that's the place with the least risk of natural disaster?
There was a great article in National Geographic that rated states by their propensity for natural disasters, and Michigan was rated among the states with the lowest. Texas and California, I believe, was the highest, along with Florida. So basically, having gone through this once, I cannot financially withstand it again, and I think, it's what's going to be a terrible tragedy is I think these people are going to rebuild. And 10, 15 years from now, there's going to be another Katrina. It's going to hit the same area, and everybody's going to be wringing their hands all over again. And let me tell you, having gone through it once, I knew that emotionally, physically, and financially, I could not do it again.
Brian, thanks very much.
Thank you. Good luck to everybody who are dealing with Katrina.
Yeah.
Brian's comments there on the bureaucracy, mentioning insurance companies and FEMA and the like, are so important. We have, as homeowners trying to rebuild, dealing with insurance companies can be highly problematic. And in this case, we've got the additional issue of that there's regular homeowner insurance and flood insurance, and there's undoubtedly going to be difficulties that people are going to experience to show what was destroyed before the flood, what was destroyed after the flood.
Walter Peacock, stay with us, will you? We have to take another short break. If you'd like to join the conversation, by the way, give us a call at 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, TOTN at NPR.org. We're also going to be talking about a political storm in California after the passage of the gay marriage bill there. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We're talking today about reconstructing American cities and towns after natural disaster, decisions that have to be made by many communities in New Orleans and all along the Mississippi Gulf Coast. Our guest is Walter Peacock. He's director of the Hazard Reduction and Recovery Center at Texas A&M and author of Hurricane Andrew, Ethnicity, Gender, and the Sociology of Disaster. Here's an email we got from Chris Batchelor in Pinedale, Wyoming. I was young when it broke, but the Teton Dam failure of June 5, 1976 affected many, many communities in the southeast Idaho area. It took years, in some cases decades, for the destroyed homes to all be demolished and the silt and filth to be cleaned up. I remember dead animals everywhere. The grain from the silos near the railroad was all over, and it smelled like fermented pig slop. Very few lives were lost, but everyone was affected. We rebuilt our home mostly on our own. I recall large groups of Mennonites who came and volunteered wherever they were needed. Being a largely Mormon community, everyone helped their neighbors, took turns hauling loads to the designated areas. It's a beautiful city, but it wasn't pretty for a long time. And Walter Peacock, that's one thing we keep hearing, patience.
Patience, patience, patience is right. And I do not envy at all what so many people are going to be going through, both in terms of trying to get back, reestablish themselves there, as well as the people that simply won't go back and that are going to be dealing with the difficulties of reestablishing themselves in communities throughout our country.
Let's get another caller on the line, and this is Mitch. Mitch calling us from San Francisco.
Hi, good afternoon.
Afternoon.
I live in San Francisco, despite the risk to earthquakes, because each time there's an earthquake, we learn a great deal about engineering from the disaster. And just as Holland is below sea level, they've managed to take the risk of floods quite seriously in the past and worked to technologically redevelop the area. It's not beyond a feat of human engineering to preserve a city like New Orleans, which has as much historical relevance as Philadelphia. I mean, it's a significant city that's loved throughout the world, and to think that we couldn't hold a little water back is kind of ridiculous, I think.
More than a little water, Mitch, but he does make a point, Walter Peacock, and of course the Dutch learned their lesson in 1953 after disastrous floods.
You're right. There often is a window of opportunity where we can reassess the situation and perhaps learn from them. I think California is a wonderful example of how they have dealt with the issue of earthquake risk, and continually after event after event, rebuilding codes are looked at, issues about making our homes more seismically safe. Same thing with respect to wind in Florida. The problem often is that we forget those lessons. And I'll have to be honest that in the post 9/11 world that we live in now, I think there has been a moving away from mitigation related to natural hazards, and I hope indeed that this is a new window of opportunity, and we will relook at FEMA, we will relook at local and federal government emphasis on building back better and learning the lessons and not forgetting those lessons.
Mitch, thanks very much.
Yeah, you bet.
And let's see if we get one more caller in on this. This is Pete. Pete calling from Charlotte, North Carolina.
Hey, how are y'all today?
Very well.
I'm a native New Orleanian, and while this is a tremendous tragedy from a historical perspective, New Orleans was a city that was very sick. As far as the school system was abysmal, and many about to be taken over by the state, the political system has been inherently corrupt. And this, from a therapeutic standpoint, might be a golden opportunity to really rethink and rework not only the physical city, but also the psychological part of the city, and get rid of some of that corruption. To me, it's sort of a cleansing. And this tragedy, I mean, from a personal perspective, has cost my family dearly. Three of my family members are now no longer living in New Orleans right now. So we need to look at the other side of this. This is a city with major problems. And now we're going to be able to hopefully do it again and do it much better.
The point you've been making, Walter.
A window of opportunity. And we see that also happen after disasters throughout the United States, that oftentimes corrupt local governments are re-examined. You know, there's a kind of a breaking open of that social fabric and a political fabric, and we can see a little bit behind the scenes and reevaluate those things. And I would have to agree. I mean, there were and there are some fundamental problems there at the local level as well, too, and perhaps this will be a rebirth, a reopening, but it has to be a comprehensive redevelopment strategy here so it is all-inclusive and not just focusing on one component of the population or the business community.
And the interesting thing about the city, the parts that are the most attractive parts are still intact. Uptown, Garden District, French Quarter, Bywater, those areas are pretty much intact.
Yeah, as they say, what is it, the water flows away from money in New Orleans?
Huh?
it's not by accident that some of those more attractive areas are built on the higher elevations, and indeed some of the more difficult areas.
We also need to look at the history of the city and how it was developed.
Mm-hmm.
It was developed by the river because that was the only high land.
Mm-hmm.
And those folks being in those lower areas, it wasn't by design that we put them in that area. That was just the way things played out.
Pete, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you, Neil.
And Walter Peacock, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much. My thoughts and prayers are with everybody there in New Orleans, and I hope we all come to their assistance.
So say we all. Walter Peacock, Director of Hazard Reduction and Recovery Center at Texas A&M, and we thank him for his time. On September 8th, 1900, the anniversary is tomorrow, a hurricane hit Galveston, Texas, that until last week was considered the deadliest natural disaster in U.S. history. Galveston obviously still exists. The storm eternally altered the city's destiny. Joining us now to tell us the story is Casey Green, head of the Special Collections at the Rosenberg Library in Galveston, Texas, and thanks very much for being with us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit about Galveston before the storm.
Well, first of all, my sympathies with everyone who's been affected by this horrible disaster. Galveston was Texas' principal city and seaport in the 19th century. The city itself was thriving economically. We were a boom town, but the local government was bankrupt. And at that time, we had ward politics. The hurricane came September 8th. 1900, and literally the whole city and island of Galveston were inundated by floodwaters. How many people died? We don't know. We estimate upwards of 8,000 on Galveston Island alone and several thousand more on the mainland, making this to date the nation's deadliest natural disaster. But Galveston did rebuild in a dramatic, total way. And I agree with what most of your callers have said, that this offers the opportunity to do it right and to make substantial and transformational changes to the city of New Orleans and the Middle Gulf Coast.
But after the storm, we all read that the city of Houston, Texas, about 50 miles away up the Ship Canal, Houston became the principal commercial city of Texas, and Galveston never recovered.
Well, there's a reason for that, because Galveston was recovering at a time in 1901 that the state's economy shifted from agriculture to oil. We had the Spindletop oil boom. Now, Houston started becoming the oil capital of the United States in the 1920s, so the change was gradual. It didn't happen overnight. Galveston in 1901 pioneered the commission form of local government, and Houston and a couple of hundred other American cities eventually adopted it. And this simply meant that professional businessmen were in charge of various city departments, and they operated their departments in a business-like manner, accountable to the people of Galveston. No, we also had some fiscal changes that dramatically transformed the local landscape. First, a seawall 17 feet high was built to protect the city from the Gulf of Mexico between 1902 and 1904, and it was extended in later years. And then after that, we had the elevation of the cities. It was called the grade raising. Literally, the city was raised from an elevation about 8 feet along our principal east-west thoroughfare to a height of just under, just about 16 feet behind our seawall. And this was called the grade raising, and it took place between 1904 and 1910, and it was extended westward in subsequent years. And then third, we also had the construction of a causeway that handled vehicular, foot, and railroad traffic that connected Galveston and Galveston Island to the mainland of Texas. So between 1900 and 1912, Galveston transformed itself radically in terms of its local politics and technologically as well. And all I'd like to say is that Galveston offers an opportunity to study how one city 105 years ago changed itself in light of a terrible disaster.
And could now, ironically, be among those cities that could reap some economic benefits from the distress elsewhere.
Well, we have our share of evacuees here from New Orleans. Of course, Texas has taken a huge share of people, mm-hmm. victims, as have other states. I don't know about Galveston benefiting directly from this terrible disaster, but we do provide a model for studying how one city over a century ago changed itself in response to a hurricane.
Casey Green, thanks very much. We appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
Casey Green, the head of special collections at the Rosenberg Library in Galveston, Texas, and he joined us from his office there. You're listening to Talk of the Nation, which is coming to you from NPR News.